name's Christopher Graham. I'm the Information Commissioner. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here to the Museum of Science and Industry for this first ICO Alan Turing lecture. First of all, the ICO, Information Commissioner's Office, is based in Wilmslow. And Wilmslow is where Alan Turing lived for the last 6 years of his life. And it gives me the opportunity to explain, for those of you who don't know, that the Information Commissioner's Office is there to patrol the Data Protection Act and the Freedom of Information Act. That's basically what we do. We're there to make sure that we can help citizens and consumers assert their rights under legislation, the right to privacy and the right to know. Now, it's not just because Alan Turing lived for the last 6 years of his life in Wilmslow that we've got into this Alan Turing year, the centenary year. It's also because the more we understand about Alan Turing, the more we realize that things he did, things he discovered, things that he represented, wittingly or unwittingly, at the time or subsequently, are so much about what we do. We are about computers. We are about codes. We are about privacy. We are about secrecy. We are about rights. And as we listen to Professor Andrew, I'm sure you will see the synergy there. Ladies and gentlemen, it's with great pleasure that I call upon Christopher Andrew to talk to us tonight.
Thank you. Well, thank you to you, and in particular to Christopher Graham, for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of the lessons I think we can draw from this extraordinary life. It's only just beginning to sink in, I think, how much we have to learn from this extraordinary life. So just to sum it up in a sentence or two before I begin to attempt to draw some lessons. Alan Turing was unique, and he was unique in at least three ways. He was unique in founding computer science. He was unique in the contribution that he made to accelerating the victory over Adolf Hitler. And he was, sadly, also unique in receiving many years too late, only 3 years ago, an official apology from the then Prime Minister for the homophobic, although legally accepted at the time, persecution, which probably drove him to suicide. So it is an extraordinary life, and that particular combination, I think, I hope, will never be duplicated. So that's how a wonderful life began to end, with Alan Turing being sentenced to what was described at the time as chemical castration in 1952 as the only way of avoiding going to jail. And that is the memorial outside his house. And that's, I suppose, the symbol that most summarizes him. It's widely believed that the Apple logo, which I think is the best-known logo in the history of IT, was devised as a tribute to Alan Turing. It wasn't, because Alan Turing's life was not known at the point when Apple began its career. But nonetheless, even though it wasn't invented as a tribute to Alan Turing, I think it has now become a tribute to Alan Turing. Now for the lessons that I think we can learn. I mean, the tragic and inexcusable nature of the persecution to which he was subject in the last few years of his life, I think, tends to lead us to forget how it was that he achieved so much. And how did he achieve so much? He achieved so much because, actually, until relatively late in his inadequately long life, he lived in one of the least homophobic societies, not simply in Britain, but anywhere in the Western world. And secondly, he had opportunities to develop his eccentric and brilliant understanding of science in a way that most, I think, British children do not have nowadays. So there are lessons to be learned, it seemed to me, even for the 21st century. Now, this is one of the first reliable images that we have of Alan Turing at prep school, other than the formal school portraits. I say reliable because it was drawn by his mother, and it was sent by his mother to the matron at his prep school, who also saw some of Alan's extraordinary qualities. And what it shows is, I think, something which most school children would have difficulty in doing nowadays. So there he is, Alan watching the daisies. He's watching the daisies not really because he sees them as beautiful, but because he is an immensely curious scientist. The number of children at British schools nowadays who could wander off the games pitch to pursue some scientific inquiry is, even though it wasn't available to all British children in the 1920s, I think rather fewer than it is nowadays than it was then. Now, what is also the case, and I'll come on in a moment to a report which I think to be really rather important, by the Commons, House of Commons, and Science and Technology, Science and Education Committee, of why more British children should have the kind of education that Alan Turing had. Now, if you look, and it is possible to look in his papers in King's College, Cambridge, at the letters to his parents that he wrote even at primary school age, this is a young inventor who is not suffering from peer pressure by people telling him that, come out with us in the evening. What are you bothered by science for? So here's a letter. Dear Mother and Daddy, even the address notice is unusual. Most people would say either Dear Mommy and Daddy or Dear Mother and Father, but Alan Turing chose his own address. Guess what I am writing with? It is an invention of my own. It is a fountain pen like this, and then there's an incomprehensible diagram. Then one of the other things that he was fascinated in as a very young child was typewriters. So this week I thought of how I might make a typewriter like this. Unfortunately, he had invented the green ink in which he wrote the instructions, and it hasn't survived very well the passage of the years. But there's an extraordinary link between one of the earliest inventions that he was trying to make and his extraordinary success during the Second World War. Because, of course, his greatest success during the Second World War was decrypting the World War II German Enigma machine. But by the time he did that, he had already been thinking about typewriters for 20 years. I remember that the most, before I became a historian, for reasons that I won't rehearse, easily the most exciting intellectual thing that happened to me in my early and mid-teens was that I was given by my parents for Christmas Lotz Chemistry Set number 6. Lotz Chemistry Set is not number 6, it's not available because most of the experiments, and I don't exaggerate, have been banned by health and safety. Health and safety is blamed for many things which it's not responsible, but it has, I think, not been helpful to the future of British science. So just imagine asking Father Christmas, a.k.a. Mother, for an earthenware retort for some high heat actions. What would Father Christmas respond to that? I think probably not helpfully. Now, for the lessons we can learn from that. One of the worst ways in which, in my judgment, not simply my judgment, the Science and Technology Committee, that it's possible to shortchange budding scientists in this country is not to give them the opportunity at school for chemical practicals, chemistry practicals in particular, and not just those. Now, I can think of schools, including those maintained schools, I should add, that my own children have been at, where they do that. But I know from talking to students who come to Cambridge University that many have been to schools where the only contact which they get with chemistry practicals is either seeing the teacher doing it or else, even worse, seeing videos of it. Every parent's evening, it seems to me, the school should be questioned by parents, and not simply by parents, as to whether they're getting that. The Commons report includes comments like this, and I'm not going to name the College of Further Education. The hairdressing students get a nice new salon. The graphics students get shiny Apple Macs. The physics students get dusty old equipment held together with masking tape. Now, if it had been like that when Alan Turing was growing up, it's really quite difficult to imagine how he would have had such a wonderful career. So there are lessons to be learned. When he moves from school, and I haven't got left myself much time to talk about the schools, to university, he goes to King's College, Cambridge. He becomes an undergraduate in 1931. Now, one of the lessons I think we can learn from that is that King's College, Cambridge, more than anywhere else in the Western world that I can think of, was a place where gay intellectuals could feel at home, because they were surrounded by some of the most brilliant gay intellectuals in modern history. This is Turing shortly before he arrives at King's. And King's was already known for the two of the greatest gay authors in modern British history, Lytton Strachey and E.M. Forster, but not simply then. John Maynard Keynes, and you can find in Alan Hodge's book the full quotation from this. Apart from being probably the greatest economist of the 20th century, somebody who is doomed to be misquoted, as he always is, at the TUC conference, at the Conservative Party conference, at the Labour Party conference, at the Lib Dem conference, and probably at other conferences as well, was explicit about repudiating conventional sexual morality. And you could do it in King's. Why? Because the police would never go in unless they were invited in by the college authorities, which was not going to happen. So we entirely repudiated customary morals, and down to the end, we recognized no moral obligation on us to conform or to obey. And here's Keynes with one of his best-known lovers. And of course, in those days, as to a lesser extent now, most people, whatever their sexual orientation, did not make a list of their lovers. But Keynes did, and this is one of his best-known lovers, the artist Duncan Grant. But he also identifies as one of his lovers, and going back to the, at Eton, the time they spent at Eton College together, Dilly Knox, King's classicist. He wasn't simply a King's classicist. He was the greatest codebreaker of World War I. And one can see the way in which he prepares the way for Alan Turing in World War II. So the greatest code-breaking center of World War I was not at Bletchley Park. It was Room 40 in the old Admiralty buildings, just on the other side. It's now better known for where the beach volleyball took place. But if you look at the if you look at the Whitehall Head, that's what it looks like. But Dilly Knox had a brilliantly original personality. He had grasped something which I think students have forgotten nowadays, that the best place to, you know, if you get stuck with a problem, don't carry on looking at a blank sheet of paper, or as they did in those days. Don't carry on looking at your computer screen. No, go and have a bath, because all of us, when we're lying in a bath, relaxing, that's the place to get new ideas. Showers don't work. I mean, when students are revising, I tell them, don't have showers, have baths, because with all that water pounding on your head, how are you going to get sensible ideas? If they would take my advice, I believe we would get 5% more first at Cambridge University. But that's, anyway, that's just my my view. Now, Frank Birch, who was also from King's College at Cambridge and was the Director of Studies in History, wrote a little poem about Dilly Knox. The bath, by the way, was in room 53 in the old Admiralty building. The sailor in room 53 has never, it's true, been to sea, but though not in a boat, he has yet served afloat in a bath in the Admiralty. It sort of rhymes. And between the wars, Frank Birch, you know, Frank Birch never talked about his sexual orientation, but since we can exclude the fact that he was heterosexual, there is a distinct possibility that he was, in fact, gay. And he appears regularly in pantomime at the London Palladium, which no other Cambridge Don does nowadays, where he's still, I believe, remembered for giving the definitive performance as the widow Twankey in Aladdin. And amongst the people that Turing met and took courses from, you'll find this in Alan Hodges' book, is Ludwig Wittgenstein, who for a brief period was in the same class in an Austrian-German Gymnasium as Adolf Hitler, an extraordinary life. But he came to Cambridge, where he believed himself to be the greatest philosopher in to spend time in modern Britain, and many other people agree with that. He's also gay, and he also contemplates suicide during World War II. And then, just as an example of just how flamboyant you could be, this is Guy Burgess, Cambridge historian, apostle, Soviet spy at Trinity College, Cambridge. And it's he who gives rise to this, not Alan Turing. It's Alan Turing was investigated by the Manchester police. Guy Burgess was investigated by MI5. There is believed to be, after he and Donald MacLean defect to Russia in 1951, to be a particular problem about gays as a security risk. I don't want to be too flippant about this, but actually, Cambridge spies were remarkably evenly balanced in their sexual orientation. The five great Cambridge spies, the best the KGB believed in its entire history, were known as the Magnificent Five. And there were 2.5 of each orientation. Donald MacLean was bisexual. Guy Burgess and Anthony Blunt were committedly gay. And Kim Philby and John Cancross were equally committed heterosexuals. So nothing particularly sinister about that. Once in King's, Turing gets on okay. I mean, he's not somebody gifted with enormous social skills, but he does take part in a number of things, like rowing, for example. And then, which I think gives particular credit to King's, I mean, in those days, universities could admit people, elect them to jobs simply because they were brilliant. They didn't have to have the kind of boring CVs that successful applicants have nowadays. So there he is. He's elected a Fellow of King's at the age of only 22. He took his final degree only a year before. He did very well, but he hadn't done very well in his midterm examinations. And secondly, the piece of paper, the research project, which impressed Keynes, who was his chief backer, was the fact that he had solved a really difficult mathematical problem. Well, he did, but he hadn't bothered to check if anybody had solved it before. And somebody had, in fact, solved it in 1922. Nonetheless, you know, things were so organized in those days that being brilliant was a sufficient qualification for being made a university lecturer or equivalent. I hope we may live to see those days again, but I very much doubt it. So here he is again, and there are not all that many pictures of Turing relaxing. But this is on the eve, the month before the outbreak of the Second World War. He's with another King's Fellow, Fred Clayton, who's just behind him, with two young Austrian refugees who they've helped find asylum. And I think he looks relaxed, and I think the reason that he looks relaxed is that he was relaxed. And then, of course, he moves to Bletchley Park. The most successful intelligence agency in British history, which shortened the Second World War in the way that we all know. And this is his statue nowadays at Bletchley Park. And this is the invention, which was due mainly to him, which began the breaking of the hitherto unbreakable or almost unbreakable German Enigma machine ciphers, the bomb. With an E on the end, so-called actually not after its destructive power, but after an ice cream, which is now working again at Bletchley Park. But at Bletchley Park, he meets Dilly Knox, who we now know had actually, a year or so before, made the first break in Enigma. This was the variation of Enigma, which was used by the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, when it was assisting Franco's fascist forces in Spain. So there's Dilly Knox's hut at Bletchley. And what is crucially important is the fact that the tradition of admitting brilliant eccentrics still, thanks to Dilly Knox, continues. So here from the archives of my own college, Professor E.R. Vincent, Vinca Vincent, was also at Bletchley Park, is a first-hand memory. At his billet, Dilly Knox once stayed so long that his fellow lodgers at last forced the door. They found him standing by the bath, a faint smile on his face, his gaze fixed on abstractions, both taps full on and the plug out. What was then passing in his mind could have solved a problem that was to win a battle. So, in other words, they were ready for Alan Turing. Now, unlike most eccentrics, most of the stories that are told by about Alan Turing are true. In other words, he really did cycle to Bletchley Park wearing a gas mask because he thought it would protect himself against colds and flu. It didn't, but on the other hand, it was not a foolish idea. He really did chain his coffee mug to the radiator. How else can you prevent people from stealing your coffee mug if you're particularly attached to it? So again, it's perfectly rational. The third thing for which there is independent corroboration, which I'll mention in a moment, is that he correctly foresaw that if he kept his life savings in pound notes, they wouldn't be worth much at the end of the war because inflation always destroys the value of money during war. So he couldn't buy gold ingots, so he turned it into silver ingots, and he buried them in the Bletchley Woods. And he was a tragic figure after the Second World War as he wandered around the Bletchley Woods trying to work out where the hell he'd put the silver ingots. Now, when I put that the story in the King's College, Cambridge, I'm from Corpus Christi College, so not a member of King's, that story, I'm delighted to say there was a letter in the King's College magazine, King's Parade, as it's called, from somebody who had actually accompanied him while he was doing this. So one of these days, some nerd and an anorak, some immensely distinguished computer scientist, will discover in the Bletchley Woods, if it hasn't been built over, which it may have been, the life savings of Britain's greatest codebreaker, or just possibly not. Now, the next dimension that I'd like to look at is that in any walk of life, it doesn't matter how good the information you are producing unless the person to whom it goes is prepared to use it. And by an extraordinary coincidence, for which it's difficult to avoid believing that Providence had some hand, Winston Churchill arrives as British Prime Minister in May 1940. Winston, and I really can't think of any historian who would doubt this conclusion, first understood intelligence and how it could be used, not merely better, but vastly better than any British Prime Minister. I mean, if Churchill was brilliant, his predecessor, Neville Chamberlain, was special needs. And secondly, there was absolutely no other world leader who was remotely in the same class. Next thing is that Churchill actually went to Bletchley Park. Now, it might seem an obvious thing to do, but no world leader, no British leader had ever been to a code-breaking headquarters before. And Churchill knew that some of them would be a bit odd, and indeed he would have been extremely disappointed if some of them had not been a bit odd. So standing on the stump of an old oak tree, he says, "I told you to leave no stone unturned in your recruiting. I had no idea you had taken me so literally." And at that point, I imagine he was fixing Alan Turing in his eye. But Turing understood what to do. October 1941, unless they get more resources, they're not going to be able to carry on doing the business. So Turing and the other three leading code breakers at Bletchley Park get together, send the most junior of them, Stuart Milner Barrett, later a Treasury Knight, to deliver to number 10 Downing Street and appeal for more resources. It doesn't take 24 hours for Churchill to slap on one of his famous stickers, "Action this day," and to put beneath it in his own handwriting, which I didn't do, is illegible and therefore I haven't to reproduce, "Make sure they have all they want on extreme priority and report to me that this has been done." The idea that anybody in Germany would send a message like that to Adolf Hitler, or anybody in Russia would send a message like that to Joseph Stalin, or actually, even that in the United States, anyone would send a message like that to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. No possibility.